Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington, D.C.
Our constitution permits freedom of association, you know, and that the attempt by the military to criminalize freedom of association by arresting this female soldier that simply responded to an emotional act, an act of love.
The Nigerian military arrested a female soldier for accepting a marriage proposal while on duty, a move that is drawing sharp criticisms from civil society and women's groups.
In the past 1 week, they have arrested four of them, three journalists and one activist to be precise. In the month of November, they also arrested one activist, the diaspora, who was visiting Togo. And previously, they have arrested many others that are still in jail and have not been tried until today.
Groups condemn the arrest of journalists and human rights activists in Togo.
Our constituent view has been that we need a comprehensive governance reforms rather as a country in order to deal with the systematic corruption that we have been witnessing, which mainly has been arising from issues to do with public procurement.
And ActionAid says efforts to root out corruption appear to be ineffective in Zambia. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The political pressure group Concern Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law has sharply condemned the recent arrest of a female soldier for accepting a marriage proposal while on duty. The military accuses her of violating its code of conduct. The group says the military's move violates the female officer's fundamental right as guaranteed by the Constitution. The marriage proposal, which was captured on video and has gone viral, occurred during a youth training program in Kwara State. Civil society groups have condemned the arrest as misogynistic and discriminatory. They argue that male soldiers have not been harshly treated for the same alleged offense committed by the female officer. Deji Adeyanju is the convener for Concern Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law. He tells me that the soldier should file a court petition to ensure her constitutional rights are protected.
Our constitution permits freedom of association, you know, and that the attempt by the military to criminalize freedom of association by arresting this female soldier that simply responded to an emotional act, an act of love from a youth couple, is unacceptable, is condemnable, and it's an act that we must rise collectively as citizens to resist. We must also rise as, to ensure that people can practice what they believe in. People can have feelings for others irrespective of their social status. So this is why I have condemned the arrest and detention of the female officer. You know, and I enjoin all Nigerians to do the same thing, and even the entire civil society in the country should do the same thing.
Akinlabi Sofiat, the soldier that you're talking about, the military says will be penalized for violating military rules and regulations. The military says it's in the laws of the military to punish her for violating their rules. How do you respond to that?
The rule is inconsistent with the provision of the 1999 Constitution as amended. And the Constitution itself, which is the ground norm of our country, has said that any law or any rule or any sub-legislation or by-legislation, whether it be a rule set up by a tribunal, whether it be a rule of a subsidiary legislation like the military is currently now relying on, that is inconsistent with the provisions of the Constitution, that rule or that law shall be rendered null and void to the extent of its inconsistency. And that is what is must currently apply. And the court in several cases, one of the most celebrated, you know, on the issue of freedom of association, is the case of AG Federation versus Atiku Abubakar, where the former vice president was taken to court after he left the then PDP to join ACN to run for presidential office, and the president declared his office vacant. And the court said, no, you cannot do that. that it, he is protected under the freedom of association, as guaranteed in the constitution, to freely associate with whoever he likes. And there are plethora of other cases, you know, and the facts in this case falls on all fours with the other cases that the courts have severally ruled that you cannot subvert the provision of freedom of association guaranteed in the constitution on the altar of some laws that are inconsistent with the constitution. So that is my response to that.
But why do you think Ms. Akinlabi Sofiyet's human rights have been violated by the military?
Yes, because the express provision of the constitution is clear. The constitution says every citizen of Nigeria to interact, to relate with other Nigerians, and marriage, love, all these things fall within the definition of interaction, freedom of association. So by saying that Sophia cannot interact, cannot love a youth copper because she's a military officer or a police officer, you know, it's a direct violation of the constitution on the ground norm of our country. It's a simple analogy.
Do you think others will take the military to court about this?
Yes, of course. It is the irreducible minimum for how to take the military to court. Because when a rights of citizens are violated, flagrantly violated, and they do nothing, what we are simply encouraging is that we are encouraging for more violations so that we are setting the template for violations, continuous violations of people's rights. And this is the barest minimum that she can do to take them to court.
But, Deji, some people are suggesting that by subjecting yourself to the rules, you cannot then violate the rules and claim that the Constitution protects you from doing A or B. That is how they are arguing. How do you respond to those who say that? She knew what she was getting into.
You know that the rules that are made by the military to govern their affairs, they are not more important than the rules governing the affairs of the nation. These laws are reprehensive. They offend doctrines of fairness. They offend doctrines of equity and good conscience. And no reasonable person, you know, can justify these laws.
Deji Adeyanju is the convener for Concern Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. In Togo, civil society groups are expressing concern about the recent arrest of journalists and human rights defenders in the West African country. This after some journalists and human rights activists were recently arrested on the alleged orders of a cabinet minister. The journalists were accused of criticizing the government on a live broadcast, which supporters of the government say was defamatory. A human rights defender was also accused of calling on the military and other state security organizations not to obey orders that undermine the constitution. Supporters of the government say the rights defender's statement is a threat to national security. They called for the journalists and defenders to be prosecuted to the full force of the law to serve as deterrent. Farida Bemba Namburema is a prominent Togolese activist. She tells me that it is unacceptable for the journalists and human rights defenders to be arrested for doing their work respectively. Farida Bemba Namburema is a prominent Togolese activist. She spoke with me from an undisclosed location.
In the past 1 week, they have arrested 4 of them, 3 journalists and 1 activist to be precise. In the month of November, they also arrested 1 activist, the diaspora, who was visiting Togo. And previously, they have arrested many others that are still in jail and have not been tried until today.
But Farid, I understand the journalists were arrested for making unguarded statements against some government officials which bordered on defamation, for which reason they were arrested when they made those statements on radio.
My take on it is that regardless of what comments the journalists made, they made those comments while exercising their functions as journalists. And in Togo, we have a press code. And in the press code, press malpractices, they have been decriminalized for many years, which means you cannot go to jail for making a mistake in your job as a journalist. As a result, there is a procedure that must be followed. We have a government regulatory board, which is called HAC, which is in charge of the audiovisual and communication sector, and which is the one that deliberates on the actions and the activities of journalists. So due process was not followed, regardless of what the journalists made as comments. The way they were arrested was completely unlawful and arbitrary. It took the phone call of one minister for the government to send soldiers to go and arrest them. And when they were arrested, they spent 2 days in prison before they were even informed of the charges against them. The lawyer asked for the official complaint, and they couldn't provide a complaint because even the complaint was not formalized yet. It was just a phone call. And we need to move away from that system of authoritarianism where the government of Togo and its officials can arrest and put in jail anybody who they think made comments that they are not happy with.
Farida, the activist, I understand, was also arrested based on the call to soldiers not to obey orders from the government. This, some people say, threatening the country's security as well as its territorial integrity. Why are you against the arrest?
This is actually hilarious because the activist Olivier Kataku was arrested for an article he published on Facebook in which he was issuing guidance to different people among the community in Togo. There were guidance for citizens, guidance for public officials, guidance for soldiers. And for the soldiers, he actually said that the government of soldiers should, the soldiers in Togo should stop respecting the orders given by the government to abuse human rights, to beat up citizens and to torture citizens. So this is actually something that is constitutional, because in Togo's constitution, in Article 159, we are called as citizens to disobey any authority that violates human rights and that violates our civil liberties. So this activist was not calling on soldiers to do a coup or to revolt against their government. They said, you do not have to obey orders that lead to the abuse of human rights. And not only this is something that the constitution in Togo says, it's also something that is very clear in multiple international mechanisms, such as the ECOWAS Protocol of Democracy and Good Governance, as well as the African Union People's Charter on Human Rights.
But Farida, the government, through its officials, have denied violating human rights. Supporters say that those who threaten national security should be dealt with in accordance with the law. And that is what the government is doing, because the government has the mandate to protect people from others who are trying to foment trouble, denying that they are undermining the constitution by violating rights. As a human rights defender, what is your response to that?
Mind you that Togo is considered an authoritarian government. When you look at the Freedom House index on countries, when it comes to the level of liberty in countries, Togo is not considered as a democratic country. Togo has been ruled by the same family for the past 54 years. The father ruled for 38 years. The son ruled for the past 16 years. He's the only president in West Africa serving a fourth term. As a result, the military regime in Togo has been very instrumental in helping that family secure power. So I disagree when people say that they are doing their job to protect the citizens of Togo. The citizens of Togo are going through a lot of abuse on at many levels. We have over 100 political prisoners in Togo that have not even been allowed to see their families for almost 2 years now. They are being held in detention. Some of them have died. 7 political prisoners have died in Togo in 2021 alone. Many others are in critical health conditions, such as Aziz Goma, for example, who is in the hospital and has lost complete usage of his leg. Those, on many occasions, the ECOWAS court has condemned Togolese officials for abusing human rights and also torturing civilians.
In Zambia, ActionAid, a civil society organization, says efforts to root out corruption appear to be ineffective. This after the country's decline in the latest Corruption Perception Index released to mark International Anti-Corruption Day. Under the theme, Say No to Corruption, ActionAid expressed concern that Zambia dropped 5 points since 2018, which it argues is due to a sharp rise in public sector fraud and mismanagement. It adds that limited access to public service is due to rampant public corruption. The group also expressed concern that public officials accused of financial malfeasance and in some cases theft of public funds are not prosecuted. Nalucha Ziba Nganga is the country director for ActionAid Zambia. She tells me that to win the fight against corruption, the authorities must ensure that no case is too small to investigate and that those responsible should be dealt with in accordance with the law, irrespective of their social status or political affiliation.
our considered view has been that we need a comprehensive governance reforms rather as a country in order to deal with a systematic corruption that we have been witnessing, which mainly has been arising from issues to do with public procurement, issues to do with conflict of interest, abuse of office, as well as the use of humanitarian and crisis situations such as COVID to avoid the normal processes of procurement and other things. Therefore, we are of the view that corruption as a geopolitical tool, it needs to be looked at in a broader context, as some of the perpetuators of corruption also have to do with multinationals in their seek and quest to expand and exploit resources. Therefore, the government has to look at domesticating some of the regional and international conventions on anti-corruption that Zambia has signed. For instance, you know, under the United Nations Anti-Corruption Convention, there are around 27 of them, and so far Zambia only has 3 of those laws. So we need to see to it that we strengthen access to information. Currently, we do not have an access to information law as a country. We also look at issues to do with state capture and weaknesses of institutions. And we also strengthen procurement and public spending can help minimize some of the risks that we are witnessing currently.
Previous governments have announced fights against corruption. What did they get wrong? And what do you think this present administration is doing that might not necessarily yield the results to fight against graft or to win the fight against graft?
Well, what we have witnessed is that they're also using routes that have been explored before by successive governments and they have not yielded results. As the perception is that most of the corruption is undertaken by politicians as well as politically exposed individuals and facilitated through the civil service. Therefore, in order for us to win this fight, we have to see that we have strengthened institutions such as how do we look at the independency and the autonomy of the anti-corruption commission, which is key and fundamental in this fight, as well as having an anti-corruption commission that is well-financed and resourced. And we need to have a budget predictability of the anti-corruption commission, unlike the trends we've been seeing over the years, which are unsustainable, as well as collective action to fight corruption. Complementary institutions also have to be strengthened. This is why we're saying the entire value chain has to be strengthened in the fight against corruption and also the protection of whistleblowers and media also plays a critical role in raising awareness and reporting fairly and objectively, as well as we need to build accountability for our own performance and need to be more accountable as a country and as a society. But more especially, even those dealing with public finance resources, corrupt behavior, as you know, is deeply rooted. Some of it is historical and politically nature due to the country context. However, it has to be more institutionalized in as far as strengthening the apex institutions dealing with issues of corruption and seeing interlinkages between politics, power, business, and money.
People have often expressed concern about politically motivated prosecution and perhaps persecution using state institutions against opponents. How can this be avoided in the fight against corruption?
When you look at the bulk of the corruption cases that Zambia has been dealing with, they are mainly politically orchestrated. So the people who have closeness to public financial resources, you have to be a politician or you have to be politically exposed. So when you come to fight against corruption in terms of the large wastages and corruption activities, looking at the various Auditor General's report as well as the Financial Intelligence report for successive years, which have been in red, you will realize that a number of entities that are reported in there are either owned by politicians, largely members of parliament, people have been cabinet ministers, or they're owned by brothers, relatives, or friends to people who have held positions in government. Therefore, the fight against corruption, most often it's usually tended to be bidded against a political opponent, and sometimes it gets to try. But yet, when they are awarding themselves those tenders, they never seem to say, why are politicians getting the tenders? And that is the biggest question we need to start asking ourselves.
Nalucha Ziba Nganga is the country director for ActionAid Zambia. She spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Still in Zambia, a new book traces the history of corruption in the Southern African country, starting from the pre-colonial period. It also explores whether graft is an indigenous problem or induced by outside influences. Brighton Tembo, the author, says the book also offers an in-depth analysis of the fight against corruption from the country's independence to the present day. Mr. Tembo is also the chief executive officer of the political pressure group Community Action Against Corruption, or CAAC. The group routinely pressures the authorities in Zambia to investigate and prosecute public officials alleged to have committed financial malfeasance. To learn more about details of the book on the fight against corruption in Zambia, I reached the author, Brighton Tembo, in the capital, Lusaka.
It is trying to get into history. As you know, without knowing the history, you cannot know your destination. So that book is giving us the history. Where did we get wrong? Because as Africans, we are people perceived to be predominantly corrupt people. Where did we get that character, which gave us that predisposition, where we are looked at to be corrupt? But according to my research, the colonial government contributed greatly.
Did your research find out or unearth the source of corruption in Zambia or how it began?
If you look at the way I've written the book, the same pattern of corruption, it is the same that you can find in other countries, not only Zambia. It is almost like the same picture. Though the book is talking about Zambia, but the picture itself is depicting sub-Saharan Africa. It could be the same problem in Nigeria, Ghana, Kenya, Zambia included.
But why are people blaming colonialists for the problem of corruption today when the act is being committed by the indigenous people themselves, in this case, Zambians?
Yeah, there is what you call mindset. If you look at the way the colonial people kept the Africans, Africans were kept in a position where they developed that hatred for government, because government institutions were used to oppress the Africans. So from that mentality, an African has a mindset which looks at government to be an enemy institution. Unfortunately, our education system as Africans has not managed to remove that mindset in us. An African, even today, is still looks at the government to be an institution which is not close to him. Africans do not want their government. They still look at government to be an institution which is not theirs. That's why stealing in Africa, stealing from government is stealing from no one. That's why presidents steal from their own people. People are still stealing from their own government. There is that separation. We don't embrace our government to be our own. An African fought in the colonial government, and still that mentality has been passed on from our forefathers to the children up to us now. We are still keeping that mentality. There is no proper relationship between government itself and us. That's why there is rampant stealing from our government. There is no relationship. We feel government is not ours. That's why an African is more close to his political party than the government which is in power. That is the question.
Corruption experts have expressed concern that successive governments since independence have not been successful in the fight to root out corruption in Zambia. What did you find as the main cause of the challenge in the fight against corruption in Zambia?
Yeah, our main challenge in fighting corruption in Zambia are the systems that we use. We have an anti-corruption commission. We have people tasked to fight corruption, but the system which they use, there are systems that are failing to address the problem of corruption. So what is there? We have to completely make a shift from the old systems of fighting corruption to the new systems of fighting corruption, because the system that we've been using, for example, here in Zambia, I cannot say there was corruption during the time of the founding father, Dr. Kenneth Kaunda. Up to 1991, Zambia started recording high-tech corruption starting 1991. So we went wrong in 1991, when we transformed from the founding father, that is Dr. Kenneth Kaunda, to Frederick Chiluba. That is where we went wrong. Because when I was doing a research, I never came across any minister during the Kaunda time who served in Dr. Kaunda's time who was taken to court or probed over corruption.
What are the key recommendations that your book comes up with
in order to be successful in the fight against corruption in Zambia and perhaps Africa?
Yeah, that's a good question. My recommendation is, one, the fight against corruption should not be taken upwards. It should come downward at society level. We have to use these three key institutions, the household, the school, and the church, within our local systems, because it is the society which supplies corrupt politicians, which supplies corrupt civil servants. So if we cannot fight corruption at society level, and we expect to fight corruption at institutional level, that is where we've gone wrong. So we have to look at means and ways of looking inwards. Let us take introspection as the people in our societies. Because if our society is clean, it cannot supply a minister, it cannot supply a president who is corrupt. So our institutions per se are not corrupt. It is the people that we are supplying in these institutions who are taking corruption in those institutions. So let us think, my recommendation is to look inwards and fight corruption in that manner.
Brighton Tembo is the Chief Executive Officer of the Political Pressure Group Community Action Against Corruption, or CAAC. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. In South Africa, the National Prosecuting Authority, or NPA, has petitioned a court seeking to block the sale of Optimum Coal Mine. It forms part of the effort by the authorities to ensure the mine is forfeited to the state. The site belongs to the Gupta family, who were accused of corruption and state capture during the administration of former President Jacob Zuma. In the court petition, the National Prosecuting Authority argues that the Gupta family acquired the mine with proceeds from corruption and state capture and should not be allowed to benefit from the alleged crime they committed. But supporters say the allegations against the family are politically motivated and made to make former President Zuma unpopular. They contend that this is yet another attempt to demonize Zuma, who was recently ordered to go back to jail to serve the rest of his 15-month jail sentence. He was imprisoned for refusing to appear before a state commission investigating corruption. For more about the court petition, I read Cindy Siwe Seboka, spokesperson for the investigating directorate of South Africa's National Prosecuting Authority.
So what we're basically saying with this application to court is that we're requesting a preservation order, and then later we'll apply for a forfeiture order. Basically, we're trying to get the Optimum Coal Holding, the mine and the terminal preserved, not subject to the business rescue practitioner's plan to possibly sell the assets at what we believe would be a throwaway price. We're also asking the court to look at our request in terms of, we're claiming that Tegeta Resources got Optimum Coal Holding through all gotten gain, through money that was siphoned off state-owned entities such as Eskom, which is the power generator for South Africa. Our main issue here is that the purchasing of Optimum Coal Mine, coal holding rather, was through all gotten gain, through money laundering, and we've actually told court that people cannot benefit from money, the money used from ill-gotten gain to be able to acquire assets, and thus we want it to be preserved and ultimately sold to the highest bidder in order to turn the mine around.
What's the court date for hearing these cases?
So what has happened this week is that we filed our application. We're not going ex parte. But what we're doing is we're doing it in open court. We're not doing it in secret to give them an opportunity, meaning the respondents, to reply. By the 8th of March 2022, arguments would be heard in this matter. Also, the respondents are given an opportunity before the 10th of January to file answering affidavits, as well as the 28th of January to then file answering affidavits to this matter. So we're saying that everything will be properly ventilated on the 8th of March 2022 through arguments, but that's for the preservation order.
What do you think are the prospects of success?
So we're fighting. We brought our best guns to this particular fight. However, it's going to be heard by the court, and it's going to be in the court's hands to decide whether our arguments are sufficient or whether our arguments are valid. However, we're doing our best, and we're putting our best foot forward.
Well, Sindisi, what do you say to those who are saying all these are politically motivated, going after so-called perceived political opponents or enemies of the state or the ruling party at the moment, the president inclusive?
They're saying that's completely false, because in each of our matters, if people were to follow all of our cases, we've been able to get an unlimited restraint order against various high-profile persons in and out of the country. In the Mulani investment matter, the court, on its own assertions, found that we do have a case, and hence they've restrained access to an unlimited value against Island Side, against Ipal Sharma, Mulani investment, where we've told the court that this was just another money laundering scheme for bigger cases. Here again, we're bringing an application. We're hoping that the court will hear it on different merits. And what we would like to put out there is that different courts are hearing our matters, and many a times the various courts are either giving us restraint orders or giving us interim restraints and confirming our restraint orders. So it cannot be that in all of our attempts and all of what we've done currently is political, because the courts are independent and the courts hear and make the final decision.
How are South Africans reacting to this latest development?
It's such a confusing or complex matter for South Africans currently, and it's a lot to take up, because even in our investigation, we ourselves realize that this is a complex and dense matter. So South Africans currently are trying to understand what it is we're doing with this particular case. They get that we want to preserve it. They get that we eventually want to forfeit it. But the sense that I'm getting is they want to understand what the end goal is. And currently, where we're standing, we are doing our best to explain what the end goal is, but it's going to play out in court, and the details will be best understood at that point.
I was going to ask you what the end goal is and whether South Africans will be brought on board and educated.
So the end goal from where we are sitting is to eventually get this mine and the terminal sold off to the highest bidder. And when that is done, it will then be able to possibly create more jobs. It's also going to be able to go back to or to go to the hands of people that want to run it correctly. Also, the state will be able to have shown that mine, a terminal, and various other things will go through ill-gotten gain. Because according to the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, you cannot benefit from proceeds of crime.
Sindisi Seboka is spokesperson for the Investigating Directorate of South Africa's National Prosecuting Authority, or NPA. She spoke with me from the capital, Pretoria. In Uganda, opposition political parties and human rights activists say the respect for human rights has significantly declined this year. They cite the recent general election and by-election where the military and police were accused of using violence to intimidate and harass opponents and their supporters in the run-up to the polls. This after Human Rights Watch, an international rights organization, said the authorities stepped up restrictions on freedom of expression and assembly ahead of the February polls. Incumbent President Yoweri Museveni, who has been in power since 1986, was declared winner of the presidential election. He received 59% of the vote, while his main challenger, the popular parliamentarian Robert Kyagulanyi, also known as Bobby Wine, came in second with 39% of the total votes cast. But citing voter irregularities and rigging, Bobby Wine and other opposition parties rejected the outcome of the poll. For analysis on the human rights situation in Uganda, I reach Aloysius Akishule, a leading member of the Kampala-based organization called the Human Rights Network.
Looking at the whole situation in terms of human rights for different groups and different people are demanding, and even the government, in as far as it is trying to uphold human rights and what, I would say we're in a better position than we have been the previous years. And of course, if you take the pandemic issue, there are some other rights, the human rights that have been violated because of the pandemic issue, lack of access to justice. Most judiciary has been locked down in a bigger part of the time, so it's difficult to access justice. Then, of course, domestic violence has increased. I would say the big problem we have now is, on the whole, is actually human rights abuse by individuals. Domestic violence, child abuse, and same for a few during election times when, of course, we had our elections.
Some opposition and civil society groups said the human rights situation in Uganda is poor because the government is using the ongoing pandemic or the fight to limit the spread of the coronavirus and its variants, including the recent Omicron variant, to clamp down on civil liberties and human rights. As a human rights defender, what is your take?
I would say yes and no. There are some rights that have been, for example, rights to assemble, rights towards rallies or meetings of political nature that have been clamped down because of use of the pandemic. Of course, the pandemic is there. Everyone can say, the majority of people understand there is a need to be careful and stuff like that. For example, you can imagine our schools are still closed. So it would, as the human rights defenders, we've tried to push to have such liberties lifted. But also there's no much appetite in the population to have to enjoy these rights fully because of the threat of the pandemic.
Talking about pushing to have the human rights of Ugandans respected, what has been the relationship between your organization and the government in terms of advocacy to ensure that the rights of Ugandans are respected?
Well, there's been dialogue, by and large. There's been dialogue, but of course, the government has been pushing, very much pushing us against, especially human rights defenders who are in advocating for human rights of political nature, right to assemble, right to what. For example, right now, DGF, which is the biggest funder, our biggest funder, is still closed. There are no current operations because of the issue of government and us, the NGOs, trying to agree on what agenda to push. So, however, there is dialogue, although it takes long. There are meetings ongoing with us and government and then the NGO bureau to have these restrictions lifted. We are hopeful to improve, but it has not been, the pandemic has not helped.
Were there any parameters or measures that you think during the discussion could be implemented quickly that Ugandans would say this was the outcome of the discussions you had with the government, for which now the government is respecting the rights of people and not undermining their rights using the pandemic as a pretext to clamp down on civil liberties in Uganda?
I would say it's a work in progress. We haven't seen tangible results or tangible commitment from government agencies say they will uphold this. But there's goodwill. There's goodwill. We are hopeful.
Aloysius Akishule is a leading member of the Kampala-based organization called the Human Rights Network. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema, says the recent dialogue among political stakeholders failed to support popular demands for a new constitution. The party says it has been vindicated for boycotting the two-day event. This after dismissing the talks as incapable of addressing the major concerns of the opposition groups.
President Samia Suluhu Hassan opened the two-day political stakeholders meeting. It was aimed at helping resolve sharp differences between the police and political parties. But opposition political parties that boycotted the meeting say most of their concerns will not be discussed at the forum, including demands for a new constitution and the use of police and state institutions to undermine freedom of expression and assembly. They also say the ruling party has narrowed political space, making it difficult for the opponents of the administration to freely engage with supporters. They cite the recent arrest of the chairman of Chadema, Freeman Mbowe, as an example of the state's use of police to intimidate and harass opponents. John Mrema is Director of Communication, Foreign Affairs and Protocols for Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema. He tells me that the party will continue to pursue dialogue with the president.
After we received the program, we knew for sure that that was not a political dialogue between political parties and the High Excellency the president. Rather, the president was just invited to be a guest of honor, and she was only supposed to give a speech of 40 minutes, and then she'll leave the place. So we thought that that is not the right place for a dialogue between political parties and the president. And that's why we decided not to attend, because our demand is to get a forum to discuss with the president on various political issues we've been facing for the last 6 years now. So that's why we are not regretting, because even the president in that meeting, she said that she'll find a time to get a dialogue with political parties, and that's what we need.
But John, some people are of the view that Chadema missed an opportunity to present your views there, so the outcome could reflect what you really wanted. So not being there, Chadema cannot say that your views were not reflected in the outcome or recommendation of the political dialogue.
We didn't miss any opportunity, because there was no any opportunity. For instance, they all agreed that they should postpone the demand for a new constitution. We are not ready for that, because that's a public outcry, public demand. So we knew, because you can imagine, a dialogue with more than 80 resolutions. How can you implement 80 resolutions from a single dialogue, a single meeting? So for sure they were just discussing things which were not of the national interest.
Whatever happened to your petition to President Samia Suluhu Hassan allowing political parties to freely, even not during election, as demanded by the Constitution? What happened to that petition or letter?
Since we wrote to President Samia Suluhu Hassan, she responded and said that she'll find a time to talk with us. But since then, since April until today, she has never get a time to talk to us. So we are still waiting for her to get time to talk to us. And the demand for political parties to have free political rallies across the country, the restrictions are still there. We are not allowed to hold the public rallies up to the moment. So we are waiting to see if this resolution, which were made last week in Dodoma, because they said that these resolutions will be implemented after 21 days. We are waiting to see if anything is going to happen, or is there just a normal table talks.
Will Chadema embark or engage in any political dialogue with the rest of political parties if indeed the ruling party will be there?
We are engaging, and we will continue engaging. Until now, we are still engaging with political parties, with civil society organizations, with prominent leaders of this country, retired leaders, national and some of them international leaders who retired. We are still engaging everybody, religious leaders. We are engaging them on various occasions on discussing the political situation in our country, the danger we are seeing ahead of us if the situation will continue to be the same. So engagement is still there, and we'll continue being engaging every well-wishers of this country. Even the international community, we are still engaging with them on various issues concerning Tanzania.
John Mrema is Director of Communication, Foreign Affairs and Protocols for Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. As 2021 draws to a close, the World Health Organization says the COVID-19 pandemic has continued to spread across Africa, deepening the health crisis in the region. For VOA, Ruben Chiama reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Africa is ending another challenging year. The World Health Organization says the COVID-19 pandemic continues, fueled by new variants, while vaccine deliveries to the continent stuttered, causing delays in vaccination drives amid intensified calls for equity. Mashidiso Moeti is the WHO Regional Director for Africa.
There have now been nearly 9 million cases of COVID-19 and nearly 225,000 reported lives lost in Africa due to the pandemic. Africa is now officially in the fourth wave of the pandemic, which is partly due to the Omicron variant. There's been an 83% surge in new cases on the continent this week compared to the previous week. This is the fastest surge recorded since May last year.
Moeti from Botswana is the first woman to be elected as WHO Regional Director for Africa. She says the region remains cautiously optimistic, recording fewer deaths during the early weeks of the current wave compared with previous surges.
Just over 3,000 deaths have been reported during the first 3 weeks of the fourth wave, and that's about half the number reported in the same period during the third wave. Additionally, evidence from South Africa is that while hospitalizations have increased by almost 70% in the past 7 days, intensive care unit bed occupancy rates remain low at 7.5%.
The OECD warns it could quickly turn into a social and economic emergency. Flavia Senkubuge is a public health medicine specialist based at the University of Pretoria.
In terms of the trends in South Africa, of course, COVID-19 was introduced in South Africa in the early 2020, and we had our peak of cases during the week of the 5th to the 11th of July. To date, we have cumulatively over 3 million cases. The positivity rate, which is the number of tests done that have a positive result, are at 31%.
Some say the COVID-19 crisis risks deepening inequality within countries and increasing social unrest. Africa's poorest are most at risk. Senkubuge, who is also vice president of the African Federation of Public Health Association, gave more details about the vaccination coverage.
As of 13 December, 40% of South Africans have received their vaccination dose and 25% are fully vaccinated. We are battling in terms of whether you call it hesitancy or indifference, but there is a concern in terms of the uptake of the vaccine. When we come to the findings on Omicron from 13 November to 4th of December, we had an exponential rise.
Less than 20 African countries met the global goal of vaccinating at least 10% of the adult population by 30th of September 2021, while nearly 90% of high-income countries met this target. As of the beginning of December 2021, only 7% of the African population has been fully vaccinated, as many countries face a surge in new infections. Moeti says, however, with the number of new cases hitting fresh record highs, the countries cannot afford to drop the guard.
Predictions are that if things continue like this, Africa may not reach the 70% vaccination coverage target until August 2024. Just 6 countries have hit the year-end target of fully vaccinating 40% of their citizens, with only 20 managing to achieve a 10% coverage.
Sub-Saharan Africa has faced a range of other major health emergencies, including cholera, Ebola, and meningitis. Despite the challenges, the region has made significant advances in health, including spearheading the novel oral polio vaccine rollout, reinforcing COVID-19 genomic sequencing and vaccination drives, as well as eliminating sleeping sickness in Cote d'Ivoire and trachoma in the Gambia. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first... Right now, it's time for music from our African collection. That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor William Eagle and producer Tracy Carter, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, If you fill your mouth with a razor, you will spit blood. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.